From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the legal door is now open for ICE to start deporting around 1,000 Iraqi nationals who've lived in the U.S. for years.
They would have a tough time at it, certainly, and unfortunately they might be kidnapped or tortured.
The mental health toll of working as a prison corrections officer.
We often talk about we're the forgotten branch of law enforcement.
The challenge in designing autonomous vehicles, us.
We are very distractible beings. So we will back away from paying attention faster than the autonomy can actually handle it.
And theater talk, including the Detroit Opera Theater's Hansel and Gretel.
It includes these magnificent oversized puppets on stage. There's a 12-foot witch that is utterly magnificent.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, in the past 2 years, four prison officers at Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson have died by suicide.
Correctional officers across the nation have a higher propensity towards drugs and alcoholism, divorce, and suicide.
Later this hour, we'll explore just what's behind this high suicide rate among corrections officers. But first, this is the day the federal government could resume deporting Iraqis to their former homeland, even as advocates warn that going back to Iraq could be a death sentence. Miriam Aukerman is with the Michigan ACLU. Miriam, why did the government get a legal green light to resume deporting people to Iraq?
Well, initially, this case started back in June of 2017 when the administration tried to suddenly deport hundreds of Iraqis who faced persecution, torture, or death in Iraq without giving them a chance to prove that their lives would be in danger if they were sent there. And we raced into court really literally to try to save their lives. And Judge Mark Goldsmith in the Federal District Court issued an order pausing those deportations basically to give people time to go to immigration court and show that they shouldn't be deported, because we don't deport people. We shouldn't deport people who are going to be persecuted, tortured, or killed. What has happened since then is that the government appealed that ruling, went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and in a 2-1 ruling back in December, the Court of Appeals basically said they didn't disagree that people who are deported to Iraq face persecution, torture, or death, but they said that the courts are powerless to stop it. That decision hasn't gone into effect yet, had not gone into effect because we sought review by the entire Court of Appeals. The entire Court of Appeals denied review, and so now that decision is going into effect. It's an appalling, appalling decision.
We're talking about, what, about 1,000 people who have final deportation orders who are most vulnerable?
There are about 1,000 people, yes, who are very vulnerable right now. During the course of the case, over 300 people have been arrested, have then filed motions to reopen their cases. And what we've seen in this case is that due process really matters. What Judge Goldsmith did was he gave people time to file their motions, and virtually all of them who have filed these motions have won, and that is because Iraq is a very, very dangerous place. But that process takes years. So many of these cases are still in process, and about 1,000 people have not yet even had the opportunity to do that. And so we're very concerned that people are going to be deported to a country where they could be persecuted, tortured, or killed without ever having a chance for an immigration court to hear those claims.
We reached out to ICE, to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and we got a statement from Rebecca Aducci, who's the field office director for their enforcement removal operations in Detroit. And I'll just read the statement and then get your reaction. Here's her statement. This decision is a decisive victory, further vindicating ICE's efforts to remove these aliens, many of whom have criminal convictions, to Iraq. The court's decision again affirms that each individual fully litigated their cases, receiving exhaustive due process. ICE is now reviewing this decision to determine its next steps. What about that claim that people received, in their words, exhaustive due process? Have they all had their day in court?
Absolutely not. Because if you got due process back in the 1980s and you ordered removed then, that was based on what Iraq was like in 1985 or 1990. That doesn't mean that given what has happened in Iraq since then, that you're not in danger now. What we know is that Iraq has changed a great deal, and that it is currently very dangerous. The question is not, was it dangerous to send you to Iraq in 1985 or 1990 when your case might have been litigated, but is it dangerous now? It doesn't matter what happened back then. What matters is, can we send people to a country where today they would be killed or persecuted or tortured? And that's the question that ICE doesn't want to answer, because in fact, when these Iraqis go to immigration court, they are winning their cases because it is so dangerous for them to be deported.
Are you aware of anyone having been picked up today, Miriam?
Not today.
Okay. What are the legal options for these people who have these final deportation orders but don't have an appeal lodged yet with an immigration judge?
Well, certainly we're advising all individuals who are at risk to immediately talk to an immigration attorney and to file the necessary papers with an immigration court to get that process started, because it is a very, very slow process, and that's why time is essential. I think the other thing that is really important here is that we're seeing bipartisan concern about this situation, because both Republican and Democratic lawmakers are calling on ICE not to deport Iraqis. They recognize that this goes against our fundamental core American commitment to due process. We don't take away people's life and liberty without due process. And so we're seeing legislators calling on ICE to stop, and we're expecting to see some further legislative action. So what we're asking people to do, if you're an Iraqi at risk, you should talk to your immigration attorney. And if you're simply a person who believes that no one should be deported to face persecution, torture, or death without due process, you should call your member of Congress and demand a legislative solution here.
Miriam Ackerman, Michigan ACLU. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
Martin Manna is the president of the Chaldean Community Foundation. He's been in Washington today trying to meet with members of Congress and the administration to press the case. Martin, how have you fared in meetings? With whom were you able to meet?
Well, I had several meetings here in D.C. The last couple of days. I got to see members from both sides of the aisle. There's some discussion, bipartisan bill that they're considering introducing here soon that would request the administration grant deferred enforced departure for Iraqi nationals, which would mean that if there is such an action by the administration or even through Congress, that members that are at risk of deportation cannot be detained or deported for the time frame that's given. So we're just trying to buy some additional time for the great work being done by the ACLU so that people have their due process in courts and give them some additional time to hopefully get their cases reopened.
And it is worth noting that just late last month, President Trump actually did issue that deferred enforced departure order for some Liberians. So there has been a precedent for this.
Yes, that was extremely helpful. And I think when you meet with certain members like the minority leader McCarthy and many others, it was great that we could point that out, that there has been precedent set now by the administration. And we think the Iraqi nationals should qualify similar to what they've done for Liberia.
But in this past couple of days, we have seen a purge at the Department of Homeland Security, including Secretary Nielsen being forced out reportedly because she wasn't hardlining enough. How might that impact your cause?
Well, certainly it's a challenge. I think for the last couple of years, there's been so much turnover there. We've been trying to plead the case. But I think when you look at what's happened to the country of Iraq, specifically since 2003 with minorities like the Chaldeans that have gone from 1.5 million to fewer than 200,000, even our government, either Secretary Kelly and then affirmed again by Vice President Pence that a genocide was committed against Chaldeans, Christians, and other minorities like Yazidis. Colin Powell said that if you break it, you know, we must fix it. And certainly it's been U.S. policy that's led to the destruction of these ancient communities. So how on one hand can we talk about, you know, helping these communities and label them victims of genocide, and on the other, sending Christians back to that same country?
Have you heard whether anyone in the Chaldean community has been picked up by ICE today?
Not today. You know, I'm traveling, but there have been some pickups over the last couple of weeks. Some have been moved to Pennsylvania, which is typically a staging ground for the Iraqi embassy here in Washington to interview them, kind of the last step before they are then given travel documents and then deported by ICE.
What do you believe would lie ahead for these Americanized Christian Iraqis, these Chaldeans, if they're sent back to Iraq?
Well, most of them came here as children, some as infants. You know, they're culturally, linguistically illiterate when it comes to understanding that country. They don't have family there, as most of the minority communities have fled the country. So the question is, you know, what lies ahead for them? Typically, people who have a criminal background or may have a criminal background are also detained by the Iraqi government. So they may sit in jail. They may be released. Certainly, they would be targeted. I mean, one need just look at the U.S. State Department's statement on traveling to Iraq, especially if you're an American or viewed as an American. So they would have a tough time at it, certainly. And unfortunately, they might be kidnapped or tortured, or there's certainly been a precedence for that as well.
Martin, there were a small handful of people from Michigan who were deported to Iraq in April 2017 and then again November 2018. Do you know how they're doing?
So many of them, I think, from my understanding, the ones that were sent back, you know, they fled the country again, and I don't know where they're at currently, but most have fled the country. There was also some reports that are unconfirmed that one of the members was kidnapped from our community, but it certainly is not somewhere that they want to be, nor would they be able to live comfortably.
Are you in touch with any of their relatives here? Are you getting any news from them, from family members?
Well, what we hear is those that have people that are detained or are concerned that they're going to be picked up, mostly families coming to see us that are the spouse and all their children are American-born citizens or are U.S. citizens, and just of utmost concern and worried about what the future will hold for their loved ones. And so, again, this whole process now is just trying to give them some additional time so that they can have due process in the courts. And hopefully, as probably the ACLU has told you, the majority of those that do get their day in court have been successful.
How do you respond to people who hear this story and say, hey, these people targeted for deportation broke the law, so they should go? What do you say to that?
Sure, I understand that. But a lot of them, they serve their time. So this is kind of like double jeopardy. So we should always follow the laws of this land. I couldn't agree with anybody more than that. But there's also this convention against torture that we cannot willingly send people to a place where they'll knowingly be put in harm's way, either persecuted because of their religion, political affiliation, or many other causes. So I'm all about the laws, but we have to follow all of them. And in this case, it's clear that those that are being sent back or will be sent back will be persecuted because of who they are and their allegiance here to the United States.
Martin Manna, president of the Chaldean Community Foundation. Martin, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Much more ahead after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for Theater Talk as we say hello to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. You and your team have been super busy covering a whole crop of new openings.
Yeah, I'm exhausted and geeked at the same time. My crew and I reviewed 9 shows this past weekend. I did 4 of them, and it's a bit tiring to handle all that, but it's also a sign of good times in the theater when there's that much to see.
Well, you know, winter is done, and it's spring is here. All right, so we're going to start in Ann Arbor with something called Murder Ballad.
Right. It's a very interesting murder mystery and actually small rock opera. It's a lover's triangle. It's steamy. It is not for the kids. I want to say that. And one of the things that makes this show, which is being produced right now by the Penny Seats in Ann Arbor, extra cool, is that it's performed in this really interesting, intimate space downtown Ann Arbor called Hathaway's Hideaway at 310 Ashley. And the cast, superb, David Mohn, Mike Sandusky, Monica Spencer, and Maya Gangadharan, who are all terrific Michigan actors that I've seen in other stuff. Music directed by Ann Arbor's own Brian Buckner. There's a live band that Brian directs. This is highly recommended. It's a really unique, interesting show in a small, intimate space.
And again, that's Murder Ballad, not for the kids, being done by the Penny Seats in Ann Arbor. And now we are off to Pinckney, where the Dio Dinner Theater always has something interesting going on.
Yeah, and this time they really do. This is a theater on a roll. They've done a couple of wonderful shows in a row that very challenging. This time they're doing The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Cynthia, this show is an accomplishment of stagecraft. This is normally a very big show. You need to depict the cathedral on stage.
Yes.
And you have to be inside the cathedral. You have to be on top of the cathedral, outside the cathedral. You need a tower. The Dio stage is not that big. But Matthew Tolmich, who's one of the founders of the theater, is a brilliant set designer and builder. And he manages to pull this off. This, of course, is an adaptation of the Victor Hugo classic. If you've not seen it, and most people probably have not, because it's a fairly new stage musical. Pioneer High School actually did it 2 years ago under a special arrangement with Disney.
So when you say Disney, this is based on the movie, the 96 movie.
The animated movie,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes.
And all the songs by Alan Menken, you know, who's written the songs for Beauty and the Beast and Newsies and a lot of the other
Little Shop of Horrors.
Exactly.
And Stephen Schwartz lyrics.
Exactly.
Yeah. Godspell and Wicked.
So it's a big show, but it's been brilliantly put together on this small stage.
Yeah, let's just remind everybody back to 96 to that wonderful Disney animated film. Here's a bit of the track.
Morning in Paris, the city awakes to the bells of Notre Dame.
The fisherman fishes,
the baker man bakes,
to the bells of Notre Dame.
To the big bells as loud as the thunder,
to the little bells soft as a song.
Yeah, we watched that a lot in my house. My daughter was very much into The Hunchback of Notre Dame. That sounds great just to see what they've done with the set.
Right, and it's, for people who may or may not have seen it, it's, you know, Quasimodo was born with a physical handicap. Both his parents died right after he was born, and he becomes the ward of his uncle Frollo, who's a Catholic monk, who's not a cleric of the Father Flanagan variety. He's a bad guy, and he keeps his nephew, Quasimodo, hidden away in the tower. He's the bell ringer. There are intertwined love stories within the play. Steve DeBrune, who is co-founder of the theater with Matt Tolmich, he plays Quasimodo, and it's not the Quasimodo that people think of from the movies. You know, with these great songs, it would be kind of strange to have the Charles Laughton Quasimodo singing these show tunes. But I can't recommend it enough for a terrific night out. And it is a dinner theater, and so dinner's included in the ticket, and that's at the Dio in Pinckney.
Very good. Now we go to the Detroit Opera House. So what's Michigan Opera Theater offering?
Well, they're doing Hansel and Gretel this week, and you can see it. You can still see it tomorrow and Friday and Sunday. It's an opera written by, and this will confuse some people, by a composer named Engelbert Humperdinck. Now, not the famed pop singer of the 60s and 70s.
Whose name was Jerry Dorsey, who took the name Engelbert Humperdinck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is a German composer from the late 19th century. And the story goes, Humperdinck's sister was developing a musical around the classic Grimm's fairy tale and asked her brother to write the music for it. The project started small, but then it grew and grew and grew. And so now we have an opera that is much beloved wherever it is performed. So the big key here for me is that this version, it includes these magnificent oversized puppets on stage. The only two actors that are, you know, you kind of see as actors are Hansel and Gretel. And all the other characters are puppets with the puppeteers inside the cut. Like there's a 12-foot witch that is utterly magnificent, and it's visually spectacular. So wonderful for the kids, and three more chances to see it at the Opera House.
All right. And then we go back down I-94 West, and we head to Chelsea. And so while Jeff Daniels is off starring in To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, his Purple Rose Theater is humming right along.
Yeah, they are doing a revival of the Arthur Miller play All My Sons. And something of a big year for Arthur Miller because they're doing All My Sons on Broadway. We had one of our theaters, the Ringwald, just did Death of a Salesman. Mm-hmm. This is it's a story of a man in during World War II who has two sons. One of the sons goes down in a crash of a plane, and his company actually supplied a key part to. And I don't want to give too much of the way of the story because some people haven't seen it or read it when they were in school. But it's beautifully written by Miller. And we talked to Guy Sandville, who's the artistic director at the Rose this week, about kind of why he chose this play and kind of why it has relevance today.
All My Sons is, in particular, I think more relevant than ever. It's a play about the American dream and the demise of the American dream. It directly addresses the tragedy that can result when the prevailing philosophy is that a thing has no value unless it generates a profit. We're still making the same mistakes. It also, on a very personal level for this family, reveals what happens, the potential destructive power of secrets and lies. It will shake you to your core, and I think that's good for everybody every once in a while.
All My Sons, that runs through June 1st, so lots of chances to see it. And I got to say, this month just brings us an incredible trove of local theater to see statewide, from Detroit to Kalamazoo and to Flint.
You know. And as always, you can get details of the shows Dave has just talked about and all kinds of other ones around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thanks for the tour.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. There's this idealized image of the future of autonomous vehicles seamlessly zipping us from point A to point B while we read a book or watch a movie. But we have a ways to go before we achieve that utopian vision. Last year, for instance, a pedestrian was struck and killed by an autonomous vehicle that was being tested in Phoenix by Uber. And a recent study from the Georgia Institute of Technology finds a potential risk with these self-driving vehicles. They may be better at sensing and detecting pedestrians with lighter skin tones. All of this has researchers looking for ways to make autonomous vehicles safer. Researchers like my guest, Walter Lasecki, Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So you're working on a project that combines human and artificial intelligence in autonomous vehicles. What is the driving question or problem behind your research?
Well, so as we know, driving is extremely dangerous, right? And yet, at the same time, it's not something that we can, like smoking, for instance, just tell people to stop doing, because it's incredibly important for our productivity, for our happiness. So instead, we're thinking of this as more of a holistic system. So you already have drivers in the car, right?
Uh-huh.
And when you have these humans that are part of this process already, what we want to be able to do is combine what they know about what's going on around them potentially, or what they understand from a scene, in a way that allows us to get over these little failure points in autonomy. So right now, we're not going to have fully autonomous vehicles, as you mentioned. So instead of just saying we will wait until the system is perfect, we want to deploy something that is both effective but also as safe as possible. So we're trying to hand off the moment-to-moment control of a vehicle that may suddenly switch from autonomous mode to help, I need help from a human driver, without necessarily requiring the person in the car to be that respondent.
Okay. Because we know if you're just driving on a uncrowded road and there's not much going on, we're probably pretty much there. The car can handle that. It's the, oh my word,
exactly.
These exceptional moments. And so you're trying to figure out a way to keep things safe there. And when you think about there are certainly a number of levels between me being completely in control and driving and me reading a book or taking a nap while
right.
This autonomous vehicle does all the driving. So you know, where are we now as far as the gradation, the levels?
Right. So there is kind of a formal specification of these different levels of autonomy that they have in autonomous vehicle research. Going from level zero, so there's six levels. You're going from level zero, which is none at all.
Which is my daily drive, an hour and a half each way. So
exactly.
That's the none at all.
No, that's the none at all. You know, and that slowly moves up towards things like cruise control. So level one would be simple control of part of the driving experience. So cruise control allows you to not worry about the exact pressure that you're putting on the pedal in order to maintain a speed, and you can just steer the car. What's new is level two, where we're starting to look at essentially fancy cruise control. We can take over more than just one element of control of the car. This is what you see in GM's Super Cruise or Tesla's Autopilot, right, where you can actually take your hands off of the wheel and the car will navigate itself for short periods of time, but you're expected to be kind of hovering over at all times to make sure it's doing the right thing. That continues to progress, you know, get more and more automated as we hit level 3, which focuses on driverless autonomy of the car, but you're still supposed to have a driver paying attention to the road, because while you don't need to be moment to moment waiting for something to go wrong, when the car realizes that it doesn't know what to do, it's going to hand back control. Mm. And of course, critical events on the road might happen with only a couple seconds of lead time. I realize something entered the lane. I don't know what it is as the autonomous vehicle. And so immediately we just pop back control to the human.
Of course, can I ask if that's what where the Uber car in the Uber test car in Phoenix was at?
Yeah, so it was somewhere between
kind of two and three.
Okay. Yeah. The problem that it was mostly that they were testing it in kind of a level 3 mode, but the driver, the human driver, wasn't paying attention. Mm-hmm. Right, so they weren't able to intervene when there was a problem. There's some evidence that they did have an unknown object entering the road. And that turned out, unfortunately, to be a person, and the car did not account for that.
Okay. Then moving up to level 4.
So level 4 is you really can stop paying attention to the road, but only in certain scenarios. So when you get on the highway, you know, you can climb in the back seat for a nap is the dream anyway of level 4, okay. But only on the highway. So you can't handle other scenarios. It might be only on the highway when, you know, it's sunny outside and the weather's good and no other complications come online. And then 5 is kind of the ultimate dream of self-driver cars. We can uninstall the steering wheel and the pedals, and you just get into a mobile living room. But we are quite far away from that, despite, you know, I think what people are starting to hope for, seeing these level 2 and level 3 features rolled out and tested.
Okay. So we've got a sense, and it'll certainly, as you say, be a while before we're on that rolling living room.
Yes.
in the back. So this technique that you call instantaneous crowdsourcing fits into all of this discussion and of self-driving vehicles and safety. How does it fit in?
So up to this point, all of those levels that I've described assume that the person goes from driving the car entirely themselves to slightly less and less attention paid to the road as we get better autonomy, better artificial intelligence. But even this breakdown assumes that it will still be the person in the car who is ultimately responsible for doing something about the critical event that comes up if it's a level 3 car or overseeing the navigation if it's in level 2 kind of fancy cruise control mode. Now, the problem with that is we are very distractible beings. So we will back away from paying attention faster than the autonomy can actually handle it. And you get this, like you mentioned, like driving long periods of time, right, where you're staring at the road for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and you just glaze over. And that's bad enough. But now when you believe that the car is just going to take care of it, kind of gives you this internal narrative that it's okay to not pay attention. And the last time it probably worked, I reached for something in the passenger seat and then eventually I checked my phone. And, you know, in the Arizona accident, it was somebody staring down at their lap, paying too much attention to their phone to intervene. And what we know from thinking about how humans interact with computers is that we're not good when you surprise us. You can't just say, you know, suddenly, here's something you have to pay attention to. Oh, also, it's an incredibly stressful situation that's too complex.
And you've been reading a book or doing whatever.
And you've been reading a book. You don't even know that you're on a highway exit or whatever the scenario happens to be. So now you have to look up, page that all back in, and then make a reasonably complex decision in a moment's notice. And even if you can do that, you're probably not ready to page everything back in.
Okay.
And certainly for the everyday motorist, this is going to be considerably more challenging than I think people have it in mind when they start using these features.
So this project you're working on tries to address that gap, that problem.
Exactly. So in work that was recently published just last year, we have the first way to combine multiple people's input to outperform what any person could possibly accomplish on a low-level task. So, you know, imagine grabbing the wheel and steering left around an obstacle. So we can do that level of task faster than your nervous system itself can respond.
building that into the computer controlling the car.
Exactly. We call that instantaneous crowdsourcing. So we have a crowd of people, multiple people, who we can draw in to help with this task, and we can actually collectively act faster than we could alone. And we're using this to hand off control of these control of the car in critical events that just suddenly pop up, and the system, the driving the car, realizes, I don't know what's going on here. We now can intervene with someone who is a professional driver in, you know, imagine a call center, kind of like what was backing OnStar when GM had OnStar in vehicles. And so now we can actually potentially answer, deal with this request faster than the driver in the car ever could. The hope would be that we could have professional drivers who are experts at switching contexts and experts at thinking about situational awareness on the road, because they've been experienced drivers. So maybe truck drivers, you know, you hear a lot about autonomous trucks coming onto the market and kind of changing the work and employment landscape for long-haul truck drivers. You know, these are people who also have a lot of road experience. So we can start to think about, and my team has been doing a little bit of this, think about how using that expertise in a different way could keep, you know, daily commuters more safe.
Walter Lisecki is an assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan, working on autonomous vehicle research that combines human and artificial intelligence. Fascinating work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Still to come, we explore the mental health challenges facing correctional officers.
When Michael took his life, there were prisoners crying because they needed him. They were impacted by the loss of that life, too.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the fourth time in 2 years, corrections officers at the Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson lost a fellow officer to suicide. Michael Perdue, a longtime CO at Cotton, died by suicide earlier this year. And again, that bears repeating, fourth corrections officer at Cotton to die by suicide within 2 years. Corrections officers hope these suicides might focus attention onto the pressures of working with prisoners. To better understand this issue, we've reached out to Carrie Johnson, a corrections officer at the Cotton Correctional Facility. She has been there since 1995. In 2017, Carrie was named Correctional Officer of the Year. Before we begin, a note of warning, there is some graphic language in the interview, and listener discretion is advised. So you are part of the union's efforts to help understand PTSD and other mental health issues that COs face. You're doing your own research into this. And it made me wonder, does the job of guarding prisoners change you?
Oh, my. Yes, I am absolutely not the same girl that I was 24 years ago. I have changed significantly, and most of us have.
How?
I think a natural thing is that we're more guarded. Initially, when I walked into this room, I wanted that chair because the corners felt a little bit more safe than the windows and door behind me, and I could check where my escape routes are and where my threat may come from. I find myself doing that a lot at dinner and at the mall or and those things. So,
and day in, day out, having that kind of being on guard, what does that do to you?
For me, 24 years ago, I was quite social and quite, I think I would even classify myself as kind of naive to the things that are out there. My poor son, I take that helicopter mom thing to a whole new level. So personally, I just feel like I'm a little bit more recluse than I possibly was before. So, yeah.
Help us understand what it's like working there in corrections to understand what causes these changes. What don't the rest of us get?
I was speaking to a coworker today that knew that I was coming here, and I asked him, I said, what do you think needs to be said? And he said, I think that they need to know that this is a whole different world. It's a whole community. We are dealing with the day-to-day issues that men in prison deal with, and we're kind of the psychologists, the first assessors in a doctor's office. We're parents. We're managing the day-to-day issues. And this morning we had a prisoner that in his kitchen duties cut his two fingers to the bone. And that's a medical emergency. So we respond to that and we make sure that the prisoner is taken care of. We make sure that they're going to school and to dental. And I think a lot of people have this idea that they're in a cell and we're just walking by and making sure that that's happening. And that's
stuff that you see in movies.
Yes. And that's not reality. And we have a lot of duties and more every day. I mean, corrections programming is a bipartisan push to make offenders into rehabilitated, better people.
And the one that's supposed to be responsible for that on the front lines would be you. So what led you to start doing your own research into mental health issues among COs?
Well, I'm heavily involved with my union. About, I want to say, 5 years ago, the executive board started with these initiatives that we needed to talk about. And one of them was called One Voice. And One Voice was, like I said earlier, there's a bipartisan push for correctional reform. For example, there's a discussion about segregation and how long a prisoner should be held in isolation. And we found that the people working the front lines weren't involved in the conversation. And so we started talking about how could we interject our voice back into the conversation. Because like I said earlier, we're talking to the men. We're the ones that will first assess whether or not they have mental health issues. And so we were trying to get our voice back in. And one of the things that we found through all of this was that correctional officers across the nation have a higher propensity towards drugs and alcoholism, divorce, and suicide. So I was talking about it in 2017 because I was on the initiative for PTSD and correctional fatigue. And I talked about it to the Jackson Citizen Patriot about how we have to do a better job at taking care of one another and check in. And then a couple days later, my mentor, my friend, probably the most professional man I've ever worked with in my life, killed himself 4 days after retirement. And it made me feel like such a fraud. Here I am, the officer of the year of the entire state of Michigan, talking about research and how we have to do a better job at taking care of each other. And then right back in my own facility, you know, this happened. And it was devastating because he was probably one of the best men I ever knew. And since then, we've had three more. And all three of them were very important to me. And I felt like a failure a little bit when that happened because I was like, the more educated I get on the subject, the more I feel like we really don't know. The three that followed the first, each one of them were people I would never expect.
And families, friends didn't see it?
No. With Michael Perdue, I'm sure you saw in the article, she said that she knew that her husband had been dealing with depression for the last year and a half. You would have never known it at work. You would have never known it talking to him.
Just to remind everybody, I'm talking with Carrie Johnson, who's a corrections officer at the Cotton Correctional Facility, as we talk about the problem of PTSD and, in particular, suicide among corrections officers at facilities around our state, particularly at Cotton, with four corrections officers dying by suicide within 2 years. You talked about something, a term I want you to tell us more about, correctional fatigue. What is that?
Well, it's kind of like what you asked me at the beginning. How has it changed you? And for officers, something happens. Fight breaks out, right? Typical, especially in like our level four prisoners, sometimes daily. Your automatic reaction as a normal citizen is to get away from the two people fighting. Our automatic reaction is to run to it. And after years of that, I find that my heart rate, my adrenaline, doesn't even change anymore. Sometimes I'm thinking about how this just messed up the rest of the day's events that I needed to make sure happened. So here we've lost a little bit of the human element of what happens. We had a brand new officer, young, really sharp, and he was the first responder to a prisoner that was taken into segregation, and he was being held in what we call the cage because it's It's where you're strip searched before you go into segregation. And the prisoner took off his clothing and tied it around his neck and then laced it through the cage to hang himself. The new hire cracked the door, saw him, did all of the right things. Perfectly executed reaction by this new employee. 2 days later, he had seen that I was doing work on this, and he pulled me aside. And he said to me, "I can't get over the look on the guy's face. It was the strangest color." And my partners were walking around. We were away from inmates. We were back in the back. And our automatic reaction was to one-up him. Rather than say to him, "Are you okay? Let's talk about this." He told me he was having trouble sleeping after it because he kept seeing this colored face. And he's like, "I just didn't think it would be like that." And then my other partner that walked by, and he says, "Oh, you should have seen the guy at Jackson Inside 10 years ago. This is what happened." And I think our natural reaction as correctional officers, instead of taking that kid aside and saying, "Listen, you should talk to a professional. You should talk to somebody about this trouble you're having sleeping." We want to make it normal for him. Meanwhile, horror films are showing those images to scare you. And we're trying to tell him, no, that's normal. Let me tell you, the guy that came into the room to one-up the rookie, he later said to me, "You know what, Carrie? I worked segregation for years." He said, "And when I hired into this career, I loved the zoo. It was one of my favorite childhood pastimes. I love the animals." He says, "Years of working in segregation, years of going through the cells, checking to make sure that they're a live, breathing body." He says, "You know what I can't do anymore? I can't go to the zoo anymore." He's retired now, but he described that to me. And he says, "Do you know how weird that is, that I can't go to the zoo because I hate seeing the animals in their cages?" And he says, "But it's totally normal for me to see a human being in a cage." And I said, "That's correctional fatigue."
Yeah.
That's correctional fatigue.
And how open are supervisors to understanding that amongst those of you who are on the front lines?
I had a lieutenant recently that she had an officer talking to her about bullets are only 15 cents and I'm better off to my family in this way. And she was looking for a protocol in which she should, as a shift commander, take care of that guy and make sure he's okay. She says, "I know exactly what to do when a prisoner threatens suicide. I know exactly what to do. There's a whole policy directive." And she says, "I feel undone because I don't know what to do for this guy." Because a lot of people will say, "Well, get him services." Mm-hmm. And then there's a fitness for duty clause where now, is he fit for duty? And if you say he's not, now we've just made his problems worse because now he's off of work.
Tell us what the overtime situation is in Michigan correctional facilities.
Well, there's several facilities in the state that are very short. Women's Huron Valley, right around the corner from here, Cotton Facility, RMI, Michigan Reformatory in Ionia, Marquette, Branch Prison. These prisons are short-staffed. And it is routine for these correctional officers to be mandated 16 hours, 3 or 4 times a week. And what mandates mean, and a lot of the public don't know, is that you can have plans. It could be your son's last football game. You could coach a football game. And I'm sorry, the gates are frozen. You try to leave, and no, you're in prison too. You're staying. And you can make a phone call when you get relief to do so. And so you have family members waiting on you sometimes, and you're not able to go. And you have loss of family and friends support in that way. I mean, there's women at Huron Valley Women's that admittedly say, "I'm not raising my kids. I've missed out on their childhood." So mandatory overtime, it's an epidemic. It's something that the public does not realize. You know, my family still struggles with it. They're like, "What do you mean you can't come to Christmas? You have 24 years and you still don't have enough seniority to have Christmas off?" And no, actually, I don't. So it's another huge contributing factor to correctional fatigue.
So what could be changed? Let's start with the Department of Corrections that could help you and other corrections officers.
Well, there's currently a Senate bill that's been introduced, Senate Bill 228. It's a bill to create a suicide prevention commission. I think that's amazing. We've talked about the national problem. We've also found that Michigan is higher than other states. And the fact that they're introducing this bill and that they're acknowledging that there is an issue and that there should be research. And I'm happy to know that the language in this bill says that there's going to be someone in the front line talking about it. I just think we need officers at the table.
So officers would be included in this.
Yes.
But studies and research take time and commissions take time.
Yes.
What about the immediate needs?
Well, we used to have a thing called roll call. You were required to be at your shift and supervisors checked in and we congregated together. And so I think an immediate fix for me would be introducing roll call back into correctional facilities where we're required to be together, hear what happened, go out together as one, relieve the previous shift together. Michael Perdue and I walked in together every day. And the day before he killed himself, he said, "Carrie, can I talk to you for a minute?" And we were both rushing to our assignments. And I said, "Sure, give me a call." And he didn't call. And so I feel really bad about that. He doesn't speak to anyone else before he gets to his assignment. We're walking at 6 a.m. in the dark to our assignments, and he worked in healthcare every day. So he saw all of the sick prisoners, and he saw all of the prisoners that had been in a fight or prisoners that were dying. And so the second he got there, it was, you know, on, and then we never got to check in with each other. He was in a busy assignment. So roll call would be nice. The other thing is that officers are subjected to what I believe is petty discipline. If you have outside stressors, where everybody does, there's financial problems, marital problems, problems with your kids, I believe that the reason why correctional officers have the higher rate is because when dealing with these outside entities, they also are not given a relief. You know, people come to another job and they have another duty where they can get rid of that. In our job, it's strength, and there's not an avenue to worry about the other stuff. And we have very strict discipline. For a while, there were people were getting disciplined for too many pens. So if I wear this jacket and I have a pen in this jacket and then I have two pens in this jacket, I'm violating the policy. And instead of saying, "Carrie, take that other pen out to your car or throw it in the thing," I would get written up. And so the petty discipline makes it a pressure cooker when you're already dealing with negative comments from the prisoners, violence, and stuff like that. Then we don't need the petty stuff on top of it.
Bottom line, in the last few moments we have, what do you want from the public?
You know, there's already a negative tone right now for anyone in law enforcement, right? And other places, fire departments, EMTs, the police department, they're able to do good, right? We often talk about we're the forgotten branch of law enforcement. We are saving lives too. We are protecting the public too. Some of the men I work with are the bravest I've ever seen, and they don't get acknowledgement for it. They're strong, they're smart, they're college educated, many of them. And I think we're often placed in this category, like you said earlier, about, you know, we're like Andy Dufresne from the Shawshank Redemption. And we're not like that. We're not like that at all. In fact, when Michael took his life, there were prisoners crying because they needed him. They checked in with him every day when they went to go get their medication. They were impacted by the loss of that life too. We're never given, it seems, the recognition of the protection of the public that we actually do. And I guess that would be my hope, is if you see a correctional officer, that you thank them for the job that they do, because it's a tough one.
Carrie Johnson, corrections officer at the Cotton Correctional Facility, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And a word to anyone who has thought of suicide, there is help for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, calling the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, that number 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, 1-800-273-8255. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Razi Joffrey, Adam Reyes, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.